Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. COVID-19 shows no signs of abating. On the show, a UAF researcher discusses it and other emerging pathogens, including here in Alaska.
Probably a virus that is circulating in some animal around here. We want to know what is out there to kind of be prepared and detect the emergence of new viruses rather rapidly.
Karsten Hofer discusses the Alaska pox. And strongman leaderships are also on the rise around the globe. UAF geographer Kerry DeWitt says part of that stems from a vacuum in U.S. policy.
In any other administration, the way Prime Minister of India or Bolsonaro and so on, they would be getting a lot more heat from the U.S. government and criticism, and it's just not happening now.
And Chris Lott is in with Cataxa Clippings. I hope you'll stick around. Sunday, the Fairbanks Daily News Miner reported a staggering 232 new cases of COVID-19 in Alaska. Our state isn't alone. Numbers are on the rise across the country and around the world. As if that weren't worrying enough, Fairbanks recently saw another incident of the so-called Alaska pox. Both diseases likely emerged from animal populations. To help me understand the situation, I turned to Karsten Hofer, Associate Dean of Veterinary Medicine at UAF, and he's done critical research on parvo and rabies viruses. I began our conversation by asking him where viruses sit on the tree of life.
Generally, there is several characteristics that most people use to define what is alive and what isn't alive. And viruses are definitely close to that borderline between life forms and innate objects. And most scientists would put viruses on the innate side so that they're not considered alive because they don't have metabolism by themselves. So they can't use energy by themselves. They need a host cell and a host organism to really replicate themselves and make more of themselves. So that is one of the defining features that defines life, and viruses cannot do that. And therefore they are not considered alive. And I think actually this analogy of a computer virus is really a very good metaphor for viruses, because the computer virus that sits on a little memory stick or is in an email is not dangerous until it gets into a computer. So if you have this memory stick with a virus and you carry it around in your pocket, it doesn't do anything. It's not going to replicate. But if you put that memory stick into your computer and the computer virus in this case can take advantage of the computer, and then the computer can replicate the virus and send it through the internet and other users. So that is very similar to a biological virus that infects a host, gets into the host cell, so these very small building blocks of all organisms that are considered alive, and then turns this host cell into a virus factory that makes new viruses and releases those viruses in the environment that then can infect new cells. But the viruses don't do that by themselves. They basically just deliver the information to the host cell for the host cell to make new viruses.
Well, let's explore that analogy just a little bit, because I remember the last time we talked, you were doing work on rabies and you've done work on parvovirus, but they're different types of viruses, aren't they? And the instructions in that, let's say, computer stick, once that information gets into the computer, does different things once it starts replicating.
Yeah, so the viruses have a very fascinating, diverse way of doing its business. So we have even fundamentally different genomes. So the genetic information that gets passed on from one virus generation to the next, from one animal generation to the next, and in animals, plants, bacteria, fungi, and all living things, that long-term storage of information is in DNA. We all know about DNA. And some viruses use DNA as well, but other viruses have a slightly different molecule that we don't see anywhere in biology as a long-term storage for information, and that is RNA, that is in other organisms used as a short-term messenger of information, but not long-term storage because it isn't very stable. But some viruses use RNA, and that makes them very changeable. So these RNA viruses, they change a lot over time, which makes it really hard to develop therapies or vaccines against them because they change a lot.
And there's quite a broad range of viruses, aren't there?
Yeah, so there are so many viruses, and I think we're just starting to scratch the surface of how many viruses and what the diversity of viruses really is. For obvious reasons, in the past, we have mainly focused in on viruses that infect people, because they might make us sick, and that's what we care about, that might infect animals, because we either have pets or livestock that has emotional or economic value, or plant viruses that might wipe out whole harvests of certain plants. So those viruses have been of special interest. Then we have bacteriophages, those are viruses of bacteria. So viruses can also infect bacteria. And those are used a lot to unravel the basic biology of viruses. So it's basically the white mouse, the lab mouse of a virologist is often a bacteriophage, because they're a little simpler, the host is simpler than a human or an animal or a plant. So there is a vast variety of organisms. And so far, if scientists have looked hard enough, they've found viruses associated with all living things. And that includes the bacteria that live in the really hot springs in Yellowstone National Park that are like these acidic hot springs that is basically boiling acid where there's bacteria. And these bacteria have viruses that look really weird compared to other viruses. But viruses have really adapted to exploit any kind of living thing that we really have looked at very carefully so far.
Well, that's a great point, because if it's not viable until it gets into a host, do we know how they evolve?
We have quite a good understanding of how that works. So as I already mentioned, especially the RNA viruses that have this slightly different molecule to store their information, they make a lot of mistakes when they copy that molecule, because they don't have very careful proofreading. They're very quick, and they don't go through very carefully and check their work when they replicate. So it's basically copying a text by hand. And then if you make a mistake, if you don't read it again, when the next one copies that text. And so there is what's called genetic drift, where viruses slowly over time change. And then if there is a selection pressure in the environment, then they can adapt to that new environment, which could be a new host. So if a virus, for example, infects a host that in the past they haven't infected, and they can just replicate enough to keep going, then there is a lot of pressure on that virus in terms of selection to change over time. And the virus will make random mistakes, and some of them will be beneficial for the virus that then will take over the population and will replicate a little better than the rest. And then they will be, again, selected for some small changes that might increase the viability or replication competency of the virus. So that's how viruses change slowly over time. And then the selection of the environment really puts a lot of pressure on them. And especially, again, these RNA viruses, they have so many mistakes in copying that there's always a variety of different viruses in an organism. And they can adapt very rapidly to a new environment, be it a new host, be it an immune system response, be it an antiviral therapy. There is the evolution of resistance to these defense mechanisms is very rapidly evolving in viruses, which also have the advantage of having really, really high individual numbers because they're so small and so simple. So you not only have a lot of change, you also have huge numbers of viruses that are counting like in the billions and billions in one individual human, for example. So there's a lot of possibility, a lot of diversity in the viruses to pick and select the ones that are good for that specific environment.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with UAF researcher and associate dean Karsten Hoefer about viruses, including COVID-19. When we return from the break, hacking our DNA.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Alaska Edition. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. I'm talking with Associate Dean Karsten Hofer about viruses. Let's return to the conversation. Well, this goes to a fascinating aspect that I recall from our last conversation a couple of years ago. Even though it may look like the genetic information is quite simple, the end results or the behavioral repercussions of that encoding can be quite remarkable, can't they?
Yes, viruses have they're very good cell biologists. They have studied the cell biology of the host organisms for millions of years in their evolutionary history. And that allows them to really have fine-tuned their adaptation to that host. And I think viruses generally take two different strategies. There are the really sophisticated viruses that have really large genomes, and pox viruses would be the stereotypical example there, that has, you know, the pox virus or herpes viruses. They have very large genomes for a virus, with sometimes hundreds of different genes that have very different, very specific functions in manipulating, inhibiting the immune response of the host. It's kind of an arms race between these viruses and the immune system in a long-term chronic infections. Other viruses have more the approach of, I'm going to get in, I'm going to replicate very fast, and I'm going to be out before the immune system has any chance to mount a specific response, which normally takes several days or weeks. So the virus can be either very acute, very quick in, and then, you know, cause disease or not, but replicate quick and get to the next host before the original host can mount an immune response, clear the virus. Or in herpes viruses, we have these long-term infections where the virus can hide out in cells and has kind of a very sophisticated mechanism to kind of tone down its replication. So it's hiding from the immune system, and then suddenly, if the host gets stressed or otherwise weakened, the virus pops back out. And that's very sophisticated, very complicated, and they need very large genomes, relatively speaking, for that way of replicating.
I want to follow up on both the pox, obviously, because we have a new strain apparently called Alaska pox. But one last question about this behavior before we turn to where coronaviruses seem to exhibit. And that's how they jump species. For example, you mentioned that sometimes in their adaptation, they can jump from one species to another that may have different biology, and yet they adapt. How often does that happen, Karsten?
So that depends on the virus. So some viruses can infect multiple species, and rabies is one very well-known example that can infect wildlife, dogs, cats, people, basically any warm-blooded animal. Mainly it's limited to carnivores, but in the long-term maintenance of the virus. But it is also able to infect a whole bunch of other species. Basically any warm-blooded animal that they have tried, the virus could successfully infect. So that is a virus that has a very broad host range. Other viruses are generally very closely focused in on one specific host. And I would say that is probably the norm, that viruses are focused in on one host, and we all probably interact daily with a lot of viruses that don't do anything to us. They don't infect us. Again, most viruses are, in the big picture of viruses, are harmless to people, with obviously some very important exceptions to that, which are the human-adapted viruses. So any virus that is adapted to humans is obviously able to infect people. Sometimes we give our viruses to animals. So that can happen as well. Or what we care a little bit more about is if the animals give us viruses. And again, rabies would be one example. The new coronavirus would be another example. Previous coronaviruses, influenza to a certain extent, there's this fear that there might be a new influenza virus emerging from bird populations that might jump into people.
Now, given that broad range from the simple RNA viruses to more sophisticated like the pox or herpes viruses, where does coronavirus fit in this?
So we have a pretty good understanding of the basic coronavirus biology. So we know that it is an RNA virus, it is an envelope viruses. There have been coronaviruses around for a long time, but they have also been studied for quite a long time in people and animals. So they can cause related coronaviruses can cause disease, respiratory disease or intestinal disease in animals, including people. So that it's one of the viruses that is contributing to the common cold. I would call it kind of a medium-sized genome. It is not like a really big virus with a lot of different genes, but I would call it a small to medium range RNA virus that there has multiple members. And you might remember the SARS outbreak a couple of years ago, or now over a decade ago, but that was also a coronavirus. And there is the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus, or MERS, that is also a coronavirus. So there have been other coronaviruses that have jumped from animals, very likely to people, and have caused more limited outbreaks. But for example, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus has severely limited the ability of Muslims to go to the Hajj, to the pilgrimage to Mecca, because that was very limited when there was the MERS, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus. So these coronaviruses have been on the radar for quite a while, causing these very severe disease in people. And I think with the new coronavirus that causes COVID-19, we have the severe disease and the very easy spread, which hasn't been, I think, the case in other coronaviruses in the past, that the virus spreads so easily between people.
So talk about that spread for a second. Is that in droplets, aerosols, it can be inhaled and successfully be transmitted that way? Others are more contact-based. Let's say you touch something and then again, someone else comes along a little bit later and touches the same thing and then touches a face or eyes, yep, or nose. That helps with transmission. And this is part of that programming or strategy the viruses have adopted over time, right?
Yeah, so it depends on multiple things, but it's definitely part of the adaptation of a virus. And again, there's different strategies that different viruses employ. Some viruses are very hardy in the environment. They can stick around for a long period of time. And parvovirus, or the canine parvovirus, would be one of the prime examples of that. So if there's a canine parvovirus case in a veterinary clinic, which is a very severe disease in puppies, especially if they have not been vaccinated, it's really hard to clean. So there has to be very thorough cleaning with using lots of bleach to kind of clean it out so that other dogs that come in are not infected. That would be one extreme, an extremely hardy virus that is really hard to inactivate. On the other side of that spectrum, we have HIV, the human immunodeficiency virus that causes AIDS, which is a very unstable virus in the environment that gets inactivated basically immediately if it comes out of bodily fluids or the host environment. So getting infected with HIV, there needs to be very close contact. That's why it's largely a sexually transmitted disease, or transmitted by blood transfusion or sharing needles. So there's this very close contact, while the canine parvovirus, which is transmitted by the fecal oral route, so it gets shed in the diarrhea. And then if you know dog behavior, they always sniff when they see dog poop, right? And then there's a new infection. And the virus, again, it's very hardy. And, you know, if someone steps in some dog poop, gets on a plane and flies around the world, and then, you know, steps off the plane and a little crumb falls on the ground, there's probably viable or replication competent virus in there that can infect a new dog in a different country very quickly. While with other viruses, that would not happen, because they're much more labile. And that's basically the spread. And then you have everything in between.
That's UAF researcher and associate dean Carsten Hofer. We're talking about viruses this segment. When we return from the break, strategies for fighting illness. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. I'm talking with Karsten Hoefer, researcher and associate dean at UAF. Let's return to the conversation. Okay, now, keeping in mind you're not a CDC specialist here, but when scientists go about trying to figure out a vaccine, are there strategies that many scientists adopt to go there?
Yes, there are general strategies. And first off, I want to say that the speed in which we have been able to deal with things like the novel coronavirus on a scientific basis is, in my opinion, mind-blowingly fast. Looking at the virus was first detected in Wuhan, China, at the end of last year. And then within a month or so, there was a molecular test that very specifically detected the virus, which is, again, amazing. We could sequence the genome of the whole virus within a couple of weeks after first isolation. That was made kind of available so other people could develop tests. So this has been really mind-blowing, you know, fast development of diagnostic techniques. And in the past, it wasn't like this at all. I mean, if we go back to the 1918 flu, we didn't even know that it was a flu, a virus, for several years, not to talk about what specific virus or strain of the flu. Now we have genome information within days, and we can pick up if there are small changes in the virus that it might be adapting to humans and might change in its disease pattern. We can pick that up very, very rapidly. So we have lots of sequence information that was just not available through very modern kind of technology. And that gives us an edge in understanding very quickly, for example, what type of virus do we have? So we knew very rapidly that we have a coronavirus that causes this disease. So then if you know you have a coronavirus, you can look in the literature and say, what kind of compounds, what are kind of drugs have worked with other coronaviruses? So you can then try these. It's always very tricky to do that because we might not have very good animal models to work with. And obviously working with human patients is kind of very tricky and ethically loaded, and how you want to go about that to do that in a safe way that you don't harm the patient you're working with. So that's kind of one approach that you then look at. What are the drugs that have worked with similar viruses? So here with the coronavirus, we have an RNA virus. So you can look at drugs that might inhibit certain viral enzymes and molecules that replicate the RNA. You might borrow from other viruses that these drugs were used successfully in. So you now have this array of drugs that you can start with and then kind of tweak them a little bit. So that's the drug approach that people take. And then you start looking at the clinical presentation of the infection. One of the issues with the coronavirus is that initially you have an immune response, which is very positive, but that goes overboard sometimes. So which then causes severe disease in and of itself, that the immune system actually starts attacking the virus so aggressively that it causes a lot of problems. So then you might use steroids to kind of tamp that down and level it so that it is kind of helping the patient enough, but not really hurting it. On the vaccine front, which is a very different approach. So if you look at vaccines, you look more at preventing the disease. With the drugs, you generally look at treating. How do we make someone better that has a disease? In vaccines, in general, you want to prevent a disease from occurring in the first place. That is a little bit trickier because you need to have basically a vaccine that you give to the host, in this case, people, in order to elicit an immune response so that the body reacts to that vaccine, makes antibodies and other cells and cells that are part of the immune system to control this virus infection. And generally for the coronavirus, the spike protein, which is the protein that coats the virus on the outside, that is the protein that a lot of people target for vaccine development, because again, it has worked in other viruses. So they express and they make this spike protein and put some other chemicals together with it in multiple different ways. And then they try to see, does it elicit an immune response? So there's a small trial first. Is it safe? Like, do people get sick? So they have very small group of people that are volunteers to be injected. And then they very carefully study these people to make sure they don't get sick. But you have to wait for quite a while to make sure that it's safe, because sometimes problems can occur a month after you have been injected with something. So you want to be very careful and deliberate. Then you have a small group of people that you inject where you measure, is there actually an immune response? Does the immune system react to this vaccine? And then when you see that happening, then you go into what's called a phase 3 trial where you have a large number of people, something around 30, 50,000 people that get injected with this experimental vaccine. And then you generally wait and see, is there a difference between people that get the vaccines and people who don't get the vaccines in terms of how many people get coronavirus. You have to be careful that both groups have the same exposure. So for example, if you have one group that all lives in nursing homes and another group that doesn't, or you have healthcare workers who are exposed and the other group doesn't have, so you have to be careful that the groups are matched. But that takes a while to do it safely. And right now, I think in the US, there's a lot of debate about how long should we wait before we actually approve a vaccine. And that is a very difficult decision for regulators, the Food and Drug Administrations to make, because on the one hand, obviously the country, the world is looking for an effective vaccine. But on the other hand, you want to make sure that this vaccine is safe, that you don't start giving a vaccine to millions of people that then suddenly causes more harm than it helps. So this is a balance that the government regulators have to strike, which is a very tricky business that is not easy, where the right balance between safety and getting something quick to the market is.
You're listening to a conversation about viruses with UAF researcher and associate dean Carsten Hofer. When we return from the break, the Alaska pox. Listening to Alaska Edition. I'm your host, Robert Hannon, and I'm talking with UAF researcher and associate dean of veterinary medicine, Carsten Hofer. After a 5-year hiatus, researchers have recently identified a new case of the so-called Alaska pox. Let's return to our conversation. This question about vaccine brings up pox to my mind, because if I recall correctly, cowpox helped as one of the first vaccines against smallpox. Be that as it may, it looks like we have a new member of the pox family called Alaska pox. Carsten, what is the pox as a virus?
So first off, you remember correctly. So the pox virus is for humans. Again, we have obviously a very human-based view of the world. Smallpox was a devastating disease for centuries, millennia, and smallpox outbreaks have really decimated whole communities, whole cultures have declined because of smallpox. So this is a very severe disease in people, but there is a whole group of different pox viruses around that generally have a very strong preference for a specific host. So smallpox, for example, is a human disease, or was a human disease, that prefers humans. Cowpox generally infects cows most often, but can also jump to people, but then doesn't really cause a lot of disease and doesn't spread very easily from person to person. Edward Jenner in England at the end of the 18th century developed the first vaccine when he realized that milkmaids, who often got infected by cowpox from hand milking and touching the udders, did generally not get smallpox. And then he tried to inoculate a boy with cowpox and then actually intentionally tried to give him smallpox, which didn't work, and the boy was protected. So from that perspective, it was one of the first vaccines. But it is a family of viruses. So the pox viruses, pox viridae is a family of viruses, and there's multiple subgroups in there. So there's the whole classification of different viruses. And biologically, the pox viruses are quite different from the coronaviruses. So they are really big. They're DNA viruses. So they have this different chemical that stores their genetic information. And again, there's most, at least mammals, have their specific pox virus, and sometimes it jumps and can infect other species. And you're right that in 2015, there was a case of an individual in the Fairbanks area that had a skin lesion, thought clinical or medical attention for that lesion. And then they identified a pox virus, which is always kind of very concerning. And they sent samples to the CDC in Atlanta, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And they did a sequence of the virus and saw that it was a new virus. But as I said earlier, there's a lot of viruses that we don't know about. So this is not too surprising, in my opinion, that we find a new virus once in a while. Fortunately, this virus so far doesn't seem to spread very easily from person to person. So it is something that people probably just picked up, you know, from likely small rodents, and it caused individual infections with some skin lesions. But just kind of to make sure and understand the possibility where this virus might be hiding, people are looking into kind of what animals might harbor this virus.
Mm. And it's sort of interesting because the next case happened recently. So this pox virus must have been hanging out in some critter, you suggest maybe a rodent of some kind, and then got transmitted again to a human. And as I understand it, people have recovered from it relatively free of any lasting impact.
Yeah, so it's probably a virus that is circulating in some animal around here. So again, very likely based on the history, some rodent, but it's circulating in these animals. Often we have no idea how much disease these viruses cause in these rodents because we don't monitor the rodent population very carefully. They don't go to the hospital, obviously, if they get sick. And a rodent might die, and you know, many rodents might die. And if you have a garden, you might actually be happy that there are less voles around eating your carrots. So we don't really pay a lot of attention to this. To a certain extent, obviously understandable. On the other hand, especially as there's more and more interactions of people moving into more natural environments together with large scale movement and concentration of people, we want to know what is out there to kind of be prepared and detect the emergence of new viruses rather rapidly so that we can try to nip it in the bud very quickly before it turns into a big outbreak situation like we have right now with the current pandemic. So the earlier you can stop this is the better, because you have fewer cases and you can contain it much easier. Obviously, you want to jump on any kind of new virus. I mean, you don't want to be closing Fairbanks down now because we have one case of Alaska pox. So again, where that line is, when you kind of go in hard and enforce or put on restrictions on daily life is again a very difficult decision. And hindsight is 2020, but in the SARS, they went very aggressively, could contain it. Obviously, with COVID-19, the novel coronavirus that caused that disease, that didn't happen successfully. It also seemed to be much more infectious, so much more easily spread from person to person, which makes it kind of hard to contain. And now we know that there's asymptomatic carriers that, for some reason that we don't understand yet very well, I think, don't get sick but are able to spread the virus. So that always makes it really hard to eliminate or control an outbreak if you can't very easily identify individuals that are infected. If you have, for example, smallpox, it's very obvious, very visual infection with like pox in your face that you can easily identify cases. While for the novel coronavirus, you can't do that. You might have severe respiratory disease, or you might have no clinical signs at all and everything in between. A mild respiratory infection, is that a cold? Is that a COVID infection? What exactly is that? It makes it hard to distinguish and trace cases very, very effectively.
Let me just stay on that point for just a second. Given the way our civilizations are going at this point, there's a likelihood other pathogens will emerge. And so we need to have our game in play in order to meet that challenge.
Yes. So I think the preparation is key. And the difficulty is, if you don't have a pandemic, why do you want to maintain a large public health system? Why do you want to pay experts that are sitting in Atlanta doing research on some weird viruses that don't cause anything until you know that they cause something, right? So you need a certain infrastructure in place that helps to put expertise, technical infrastructure, just pure like instruments in the hands of the public health officials and researchers to be able to develop specific tests very rapidly. You can't wait and then think you can hire a whole bunch of experts that are just sitting on the street waiting to be hired. I mean, you know, the good people, they get jobs, right? So we need a well-functioning public health system, even if we don't have pandemics or if we don't have major outbreaks. So that's, I think, one thing that is very important. And we have to deal with this idea that you can be in the jungle in Africa within a day now. It's not a problem, right? I mean, if I get on a plane today, I can be probably in the Congo in less than 24 hours if I get a good connection somewhere in Europe, right? And most viruses have incubation periods that last several days. So definitely within that incubation period, if I'm on vacation on a safari somewhere, I can be perfectly healthy, feel really good, get on an airplane, you know, fly back to Fairbanks, get sick, show up at the hospital with some disease that nobody's ever seen here. And we have to be able to deal with that. How do we maintain the ability of people, which I think is very important for cultural exchange, the economy, everything that we do in modern life? How do we maintain that while at the same time keeping an eye out for the transport of viruses that we might not even know about?
Mm. Well, UAF's Carsten Hoefer, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Yeah, it was fun.
Links to Carsten Hoefer and the veterinary medicine program at UAF are on the KUAC and Northern Soundings websites. When we return from the break, Belarus and the rise of strongman governments. The country of Belarus remains a concern for those who track international developments. The country's president, Alexander Lukashenko, is facing continued protest, and he's accused of stealing a recent election. UAF Geography Professor Kerry DeWitt continues with his analysis of the country, regional geopolitics, and the worrying rise of autocratic leaders.
One of the points I think is worth making is that the way some of these governments are going is a consequence of U.S. foreign policy becoming unconcerned about what other countries are doing. In any other administration, the way Prime Minister of India or Bolsonaro and so on, they would be getting a lot more heat from the U.S. government and criticism, and it's just not happening now. It also helps that the U.K. is completely self-absorbed with its stuff. And the U.S. and the U.K. have always been the ones that sort of stand up and say, hey, that's not democratic.
And the European Union has its own issues, and it can and often does stand up and suggest sanctions, but it doesn't have the same clout as when the UK and US were joint allies.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And because the EU is made up of, let's see, how many is it now? 26 countries, they can have disagreements about how to approach things, particularly when it comes to Russia. They're skittish about being tough. France, for instance, wants to kind of handle Russia gently in order to maintain good relations for economic and diplomatic and geopolitical reasons. And what happens in Belarus, of course, is of huge interest to Russia. So the EU's response has been mitigated by disagreements about how to approach things.
So what are some of the scenarios if Lukashenko is overturned?
So this really pulls Russia into the picture. Whether Russia wants to be pulled in or not, it has to pull in. And actually, EU countries are actually engaging a lot more with Vladimir Putin. So the leaders of France and Germany and some other EU big figures are talking to Putin rather than Lukashenko. Lukashenko is a spent personality at this point. He has no validity to the EU. He has no validity to Vladimir Putin. He has no validity to his own people. So his fate is in the hands of those who have the most influence over Belarus itself. And that is, frankly, Vladimir Putin. Everybody seems to recognize that. So even the opposition candidates are careful not to say anything anti-Russian as they talk about what they want their future government to look like, because they realize Russia is going to be part of how things go no matter what. And they'd rather have a friendly overlord than a hostile one. So all that puts Putin in a difficult place. But essentially, Lukashenko is most likely going to either be forced out by violence and nasty stuff going on until he just can't stay there or gets killed, or somebody's going to talk him into stepping out. And the best scenario for everybody probably would be if Putin offers Lukashenko a comfortable escape and sanctuary somewhere in Russia for the rest of his life, in exchange for Lukashenko peacefully stepping aside, allowing new elections to go forward. And Lukashenko has reached out to Putin for help, but Putin more or less said maybe new elections would be a good idea and was not too keen about keeping Lukashenko in power or helping Lukashenko preserve his regime there. And I mentioned in another conversation with you that Lukashenko has played Russia and the EU against each other, sort of getting goodies from the EU by saying, hey, if you help me, I can fend off Russia from taking over Belarus. And then he's gone to Putin and said, hey, I need your help so that the EU isn't trying to get its claws into me. And he did that in such a way that he was getting stuff from both of them and keeping his grip on power and his economy relatively buoyant. And now nobody's going to give him anything. So he no longer has the means to stay in power that he has used for all these years. And so one way or another, he's probably going to go. Whether it's going to be ugly or peaceful is the question.
If there is a new election, it's got to be of interest to Putin, and he's not going to just watch another election go by without interfering, is he?
No. However, he's sort of acting hands-off at the moment. You know, he's had the experience of trying to shape elections a little too forcefully. In the case of Ukraine, it went through this really tumultuous process where a pro-Russian candidate became the president of Ukraine, and the demonstrations against his policies were so intense that he fled. And then they brought in more of a pro-Western president, and the outcome for Russia was that they had put their weight behind the pro-Russian candidate a little too obviously and it's a little too early, so that the people of Ukraine were already set against that person, not only because of his policies, but also because they saw him as having been essentially installed by Russia. So Putin knows better than to do that in such an obvious way. However, as I said before, the Ukrainian opposition realizes that they aren't going to get anywhere by thumbing their nose at Russia. And so let's say we have some kind of peaceful transition and new elections, the Ukrainian opposition is going to be trying to field a candidate that's going to serve their interests and also be acceptable to Putin, because someone who's not acceptable to Putin simply will not make it in. However Putin needs to rid that, he will, but someone who's not going to be friendly with Russia is just not going to get in there. Even the Europeans, I think, realize that. And that's why they're talking to Putin, you know, where do we go from here?
What do the Russian people think of these foreign entanglements?
It depends on the entanglement. So Putin's been able to really boost his popularity with, for instance, supporting Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And because he has a lot of control over the media, he was able to play that as an assertion of Russia's might in opposition to the Western powers that were all against Syria, and that boosted his popularity. And then his annexation of Crimea and the invasion of Ukraine, those have been really popular. A lot of Russians feel that Ukraine really should have been part of Russia from the time the Soviet Union dissolved, and the eastern part of Ukraine has a lot of ethnic Russians. And again, it's this Vladimir Putin standing up to the West that is always trying to criticize Russia. According to his rhetoric, they're out to undermine Russia and the great Russian tradition of no democracy, essentially, that has gone back for centuries. So he uses those things to boost his legitimacy in the eyes of his people. But it's becoming much more of a fragile situation, because the money that used to pour in from oil revenue is not there anymore, because oil prices have collapsed. So he can't grease his machine with money the way he used to. And people were pretty content as long as their salaries kept going up and up and up every year. And they're not anymore. He's starting to cut subsidies. However, he had enough time in that period of great oil revenue to undo the democratic institutions such that he can guarantee himself victory in any election. But if he doesn't have some popular support, even that can't keep him going. Actually, that's the situation Lukashenko is in now. Even a tight-fisted, brutal dictator can only hang on to power if the people don't have anything to lose by rising up and just tearing everything down, if that's what it takes. So Putin knows he's like in this fragile position, and he can't really afford another one of these, what they call color revolutions. I think in Ukraine, it was the Orange Revolution. But essentially, each time one of those revolutions takes place, it reinforces the notion that the people aren't all that happy under these authoritarian situations, and after a while won't take it anymore. And Putin has been trying to sell this idea that liberal democracy is an outmoded form of government, is an experiment that's failed, and therefore this more autocratic system is actually a better way to do things. And of course, that's the way he wants to run Russia. But when there are these popular uprisings, it contradicts his narrative that the people are happier under an autocratic system.
And Belarus is kind of critical because, as you pointed out in our last conversation, it lies between Russia and the East, if you will, and the European Union and the West.
Yes, it's sandwiched right in between. It also holds a place in Russian-Soviet kind of identity and history that's really significant. Belarus, before the Soviet Union came along, it once was the center of a significant empire that controlled a lot of Europe, and over time got whittled away or knocked off its pedestal. But even before the Soviet Union was formed, the center of Russian cultural sphere included Belarus. Then within the Soviet system, Belarus was also on the front line of the war with Germany. They lost a gigantic portion of their population in the war. And so there's this sense that Belarus played a huge role in saving the Soviet Union from the aggression of the Axis powers in World War II. And then within the whole Soviet system, Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine were always the biggest players, the most important economically. And so they stayed kind of tightly together under the Soviet system. And after things split up, Belarus and Russia have had a pretty close relationship. Lukashenko played both sides, like I said, which made it not incredibly close. But Putin has always considered Belarus to be a very important piece in its game of controlling the former Soviet sphere. So Belarus and Ukraine are central to Russia's sense of a consortium of countries that will work very tightly together. Ukraine is not cooperating so well, and Belarus is a little bit problematic, but ultimately that's the direction Putin would like to see things go. One way that this could play out would be for Putin to say to Lukashenko, maybe you could stay, but you're going to have to become a vice president of a Russian-Belarusian federation.
UAF geography professor Kerry DeWitt is a regular contributor to KUAC as we look at the world of politics around us. Kerry, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's always a pleasure.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. When we return from the break, disturbing words that have lodged in our vocabulary. Time now for Chris Lott and Cachexit Clippings.
I spent a good part of my childhood shuttling between actively racist and consciously anti-racist households. I've long since banished much of the racist language I grew up with, some of which I didn't then realize was offensive, jip, Indian giver, to Jew someone down, and another part whose offensiveness was obvious, including, horrifyingly, phrases using the N-word as a prefix to describe, among other things, improvised repair jobs, muskeg humps, and Brazil nuts. As an adult becoming increasingly sensitive over the years to words and their subtle import, it's now routine to discover, or belatedly realize the blindingly obvious about, words that are potentially racist or exclusionary. For example, it should not have taken me so long to recognize that the word slave didn't reflect the kind and kindness of language I strive to use, even in its most abstract form. It's just not that hard to replace slave over with language less likely to cause offense or be misunderstood. On the other hand, despite spending my first 47 years in Alaska, I've only recently become conscious of, and am consciously attempting to excise, even more language potentially offensive to indigenous peoples, such as spirit animal. But when researching my last show on the occasionally surprising history of the phrase Jim Crow, I discovered a world of words with unexpectedly problematic histories that's larger than I realized. Challenging etymologies alone introduce knots to the warp and weft of our complex linguistic tapestry. But the origins of words are often less important than the meanings they've acquired through use. I still remember being incensed when an aide to the mayor of Washington lost his job over the use of the word niggardly to describe a fiscal policy, and various similar incidents involving that word since, despite its origins having nothing to do with the similar-sounding N-word. Vigorously decrying censorship each time, it took me years to start wondering why I was so defensive about a word I never used, and what the cost to real people might be thanks to my theoretical commitment to free speech over considering the word in context. In the case of niggardly, two events sealed the deal for me. Ryan Paulson of the Lexitecture podcast discovered a popular 1800s song whose lyrics definitively demonstrated its intentionally racist use, making it even more likely to be understood as offensive, or worse, perceived as a dog whistle. And then reading linguist Jeff Nunberg's eloquent observation that it's a little disingenuous to pretend that you can pronounce a word like niggardly without evoking the echoes of its homonyms. Phonetics always trumps etymology. Another example, I knew the peanut gallery was a staple of the Howdy Doody show in the 50s, but I didn't realize its history extended to 1800s vaudeville. At that time, peanut gallery referred not just to the cheapest seats, but to the cheapest seats reserved for segregated black attendees. Lexicographer Stuart Flexner wrote that in the 1880s, peanut gallery was used in uncertain company as a synonym for N-word gallery or N-word heaven. Considering these two kinds of potential problems, origins and usage, brings into critical focus an eyebrow-raising number of words and phrases I only have time to sample from in list form. Grandfathered in, cakewalk, hip hip hooray, long time no see and no can do, tipping point, even the classic ice cream truck song and the jimmies that you might sprinkle on some of their wares. The origins and histories of many such words aren't crystal clear, and I'm not settled in my own mind about some of them, not to mention edge cases such as tribal or primitive. Nor have I found a bright line between making reasonably sensitive choices and falling victim to a version of the etymological fallacy, giving word origins undue priority over their subsequent use. But that's the point. Words and meanings are the result of an ongoing negotiation between parties, an endless parley whose volume ranges from the barely perceptible to a clangorous clamor, and where knowing more allows us to draw closer to finding just the right words, and words that are just. For more on the hidden histories of words, including my own list of alternatives to problematic words and phrases, resources for discovering such words and making your own decisions about them, or to listen or re-listen to this or any other Cotexic Word segment, stroll over to cotexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this week's show. I'm your host, Robert Hannon, hoping you'll join me for another edition of Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. Thanks for listening.